Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This is the week Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell puts it all on the line, pushing to nail down enough votes to pass a health care bill. It's also a week that may change the lives of millions of Americans if Congress upends the laws on how we insure and provide or don't provide. This hour on Point, the Senate Republicans' health care bill, and if it passes, what's coming at us? You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Are you backing the GOP senator's plan? Are you spooked? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me first from Washington today is Noam Levy. He covers health care for the Los Angeles Times. Noam, welcome back to On Point.
Good to be with you.
So, number one, you're watching. Here it is. It's Monday. Is this thing looking lined up to pass? We've heard all these Republican senators saying, no, maybe not, can't do it, no, but how's it look?
Well, it is honestly a little bit difficult to say right now. You noted that there are a number of senators who have voiced reservations about the bill that Senate Majority McConnell released last week. Some of them are on the right end of the Republican caucus. Some of them are more in the center. Some of them on the right are more concerned about the law not going far. Excuse me, the legislation not going far enough to roll back the Affordable Care Act. Others in the center are more concerned about issues like the rather historic cuts in the Medicaid safety net. A lot of this is to be expected with a large piece of legislation. Whether Democrats or Republicans are in charge, there are always rank-and-file members of the caucus who are going to request changes to a piece of legislation before they vote for it. And I expect that there's going to be a fair amount of horse trading that goes on over the next couple of days as Senate Majority Leader tries to get the 50 votes that he's going to need to get this across the finish line.
Are they horse trading about getting new highways built in their districts, or horse trading about getting in there and changing the substance of the legislation, or both, Noam? Some say this is fancy kabuki. Mitch McConnell's got it in the bag, and this is all just a kind of a theater, but ultimately he brings it home, or not so clear?
Well, some of it certainly is, I think, a certain amount of theater. There is some of these Republican senators have a need for various political reasons to be able to go back home to their states and say, I fought for such and such and such and such, and I got a little bit of this so I could vote for it. But I think there are also some real changes that may be in the offing to try to get some of these votes. They may not be that substantial from a policy perspective. Some of them may be more peculiar to individual states. But let's take Medicaid as an example. The Senate Republican bill would dramatically cut back Medicaid, the half-century-old safety net health program that provides health insurance coverage to some 70 million poor Americans. The Senate bill would scale back not only the expansion that happened to Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act, but would also completely change the funding formula of essentially capping how much money the federal government is going to give to states. And that's going to leave states with some pretty difficult choices going forward. Are they going to cut services? Are they going to cut who's eligible for the program? That genuinely doesn't sit well with some Republican governors around the country who are looking out over their state budgets, looking at their constituents, and seeing that some of those people are going to lose coverage, some of them very vulnerable. So I think there are some Republican senators, for example, who are genuinely concerned about the impact that level of cut might have on members of their state. That's particularly important, just to give one additional example. In the context of the current opioid epidemic, for example, a number of states that have Republican leadership, have Republican senators, are at the epicenter of the opioid crisis, Ohio being one of them, West Virginia another. Those are states that expanded Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act. Those are states where physicians, clinics, the whole medical establishment really sees Medicaid as pretty much the most important tool out there to confront this drug crisis. If the Medicaid coverage goes away, a lot of those folks who are on the front lines of that drug crisis are saying flatly, that, as one physician told me, a whole generation will be written off. So the stakes are pretty high.
It's hard sometimes just to get down to the basic facts on this. We had Kellyanne Conway, presidential counselor, yesterday on ABC's This Week with George Stephanopoulos, saying there would be no cuts to Medicaid. Here she was.
These are not cuts to Medicaid, George. This slows the rate for the future, and it allows governors more flexibility with Medicaid dollars because they're closest to the people in need.
Smoke and mirrors, what? No cuts? No cuts, she says?
So I will tell you, I've been covering Washington for almost a dozen years. I've been covering healthcare for eight. There is a level of dishonesty about this bill, particularly on the Republican side, that I haven't seen before. Cuts, I suppose, if Tom, I told you your salary is going to stay the same for the next 20 years, and you'd say, wait a minute, you're cutting my salary. And I said, no, I'm not. You're going to get exactly the same amount of money for the next 20 years.
As inflation nibbles it away.
Of course. So, I mean, it's disingenuous, to say the least, to characterize the bill that way.
All right, so let's get very honest, Noam, because you know this top to bottom, and it's so difficult for most Americans to begin to absorb. Walk us through, if these changes go through, what it's going to mean for healthcare in this country.
So, I know we only have a few minutes, so I'll try to be quick about it. I speak to a lot of hospitals, I speak to a lot of clinics, I speak to a lot of doctors, I speak to a lot of patient groups around the country, Cancer Society, AARP, others. Almost to a T, there is a level of concern out there about the disruptions that may be let loose by this bill that I haven't seen before. Obamacare obviously was pretty disruptive. We all remember sort of how the system kind of had to adjust to a lot of the new rules that were there.
Yep.
Pulling this amount of money out of healthcare, pulling this amount of assistance away from low-income patients has a ripple effect. So it's not just Mrs. Smith loses her health insurance. Now if Mrs. Smith gets sick and she goes to the doctor or the hospital, she has no way to pay for it. So now the hospital or the doctor has to make accommodations for that. How do those accommodations happen? Well, the hospitals and doctors will say, well, we need to make up our money somehow. Well, we're going to charge people who have insurance more. What does that mean? That means employers who provide a lot of the health insurance coverage to workers in this country are going to see that their bills are going to go up because they're going to get hit up to try to make up the money that hospitals and doctors lose. Well, what happens when employers get their health care costs go up? Who do you think they pass it on to? They pass it on to employees, who in turn are going to see their health insurance costs go up. Now, that level of disruption, I will say there are folks on the right, I think you may have some of them on your program later today, who argue that that math doesn't add up. But if you had 100 hospital executives, 100 physicians on your program, if you had 100 people who work with patients with serious diseases like diabetes or heart disease or cancer on your program over the next hour, I'll guarantee you 95 out of those 100 will tell you that math doesn't lie. If you do this, the impacts are going to be substantial and pretty disruptive.
The essential benefits that were guaranteed under Obamacare, what happens to that, Noam?
So one of the things that the Senate bill does, like the House bill that passed last month, is give states additional flexibility to opt out of these essential health benefits. Recall that the Affordable Care Act set in place a series of requirements on health insurers that they cover basic benefits like maternity coverage, like substance abuse treatment, like mental health, like prescription drugs even. Those baseline requirements were a response to a feeling among many in healthcare that there was too much insurance out there that had big holes in it that patients only found out about once they got sick. What critics of Obamacare and folks on the Hill on the Republican side have argued is that those requirements are too burdensome and they're pushing up the cost of health insurance. So what the law would do is let states opt out of that. Presumably a certain number of states would do that. So they would return to a time when you could buy a health plan that covered mental health, or you could buy a health plan that didn't include coverage for mental health. The impact of that, of course, is that if you need a health plan that's covering mental health, you're probably going to pay more for it, which is, of course, a back-end way of essentially charging people with pre-existing medical conditions more for their coverage.
And what about premiums and deductibles overall, and for that matter, the number of Americans who end up ultimately being covered here and or won't?
Well, we'll know a little bit more about what the potential impact of coverage will be later today when the Congressional Budget Office is expected to release its analysis of this bill. The House bill, remember, was projected to leave 23 million more people without health coverage over the next decade. In terms of what the price, what will happen to the price of a health insurance plan, a lot of that's going to depend on whether somebody needs to have comprehensive coverage or not. One of the things the Senate bill would do is, again, reduce requirements on what insurance plans have to cover.
I mean, who doesn't need comprehensive coverage? You don't know what's going to hit you.
Well, if you're 25 years old, maybe you, you're pretty healthy. Maybe you think you're invincible. Maybe you don't need, you think you don't need to have comprehensive health insurance coverage. There's a certain number of people who also feel like, if I'm healthy, why should I be paying more so that my neighbor down the street who has diabetes, so that person has to pay the same premium that I do? That's a sort of fundamental values question that the many ways the Senate bill goes right to the heart of.
But in terms of premiums and coverage, because it gets so, and deductibles, this gets so much attention. You know, they went up some in some states over under Obamacare. What's likely to happen here for whom?
Well, there seems to be a fairly good sense that deductibles will go up under the Senate bill. I mean, one of the things that the Senate Republican bill does is reduce requirements of how much health insurance, not only the type of benefits that have to be covered, but also the amount of a person's medical bill that a health plan has to cover. It's called the medical loss ratio. But essentially now there's a floor on health plans. They have to cover a minimum amount of a patient's expected medical cost. The Senate bill would lower that standard. Well, when you lower the standard of what a health plan has to cover in terms of dollars of medical care, that usually gets shifted into higher deductibles. So you're now in a situation, you might be in a situation where a consumer who currently has a $5,000 deductible, which parenthetically a lot of people feel is already too high for low and moderate income folks, may be $6,000 or $7,000 or $8,000 or $9,000.
$9,000 or eight or seven or six gets one's attention in a hurry. Noam Levy, I know we just got you for these few minutes. I'm really grateful to you for being with us today. Thanks a lot for joining us and keeping these curtains open, Noam. Thanks for your reporting.
Good to be with you.
No cuts to Medicaid, save our liberties. Protesters there last week outside Senate Majority Leader's Republican Mitch McConnell's office on Capitol Hill. We are talking this hour about the Senate Republican health care bill, the GOP push to pass it, and the reality of what it would mean. Mitch McConnell says his bill is the right alternative to President Obama's health care law. Here he was.
We'll eliminate costly Obamacare taxes that are passed on to consumers so we can put downward pressure on premiums, expand tax-free health savings accounts, and deploy targeted tax credits so we can help defray out-of-pocket costs and shift power from Washington to the states.
Push costs down, shift power to the states. Democrats saying this is not the way to go. Here was House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi.
So sad, Mr. President. Heartless. Mean and heartless. And this is the same thing. It's the same thing all over again. We'll do exactly what the House bill did. Increase cost for fewer benefits. It will have an age tax. It's people 50 to 64 may be paying as much as five times more for their benefits. Undermine Medicare by reducing years of its solvency. And tens of millions of people, we'll see what the CBO comes down with, but millions and millions and millions of people will lose their health care.
And Republicans themselves at the margins here, they are still looking to see whether they've got enough to push it through the Senate. Republican Senator Susan Collins of Maine, here she was talking with MSNBC, saying, just can't do it. Not so far.
I cannot support a bill that's going to make such deep cuts in Medicaid that it's going to shift billions of dollars of costs to our state governments.
Everybody's ears are perked this week. Everybody paying attention. You can join us this hour. Is this our healthcare future? Do you know what's here for you to gain or lose? Medicaid cuts and more. Is grandma going to have to come out of the nursing home and move in with you? Will you be looking at deductibles so big you're afraid to get treated? Or do you see something that you want coming here? Is this what you voted for? Let's get views from a couple of angles on this. With us right now via Skype from Salt Lake City, Snowbird, Utah, is Ovik Roy, president of the conservative think tank, the Foundation for Research on Equal Opportunities and Opinion Editor at Forbes magazine. Ovik Roy, thanks for joining us.
Hey, Tom, how are you?
Okay. And with me in the studio, Stuart Altman, professor of national health policy at Brandeis University. He advised President Obama on the Affordable Care Act. Stuart Altman, thanks for being here.
Thank you very much, Tom.
Obik Roy, how do you describe what, if you look at it, step back and look at it overall, what we're likely to come up with if this passes and it's put together with the House bill, what's the change you see in the offing for American health care?
Well, I think what's going to happen is you're going to see a lot of people have higher quality health coverage than they have today. And I thought, you know, Noam Levy is an advocate of the ACA, has been for 8-9 years. And
I would challenge that right off the bat. I've talked with him for a long time. He's a straight-ahead reporter, and I don't want to see his work smeared in that way.
Sorry, Tom. I just have to disagree. There were a number of factual and analytical flaws in the way he described the Senate health care bill. Maybe he hasn't had the time to review it in full. I'm not sure. But there are a lot of things about the bill that I think we have to go through that are a lot less alarming than a lot of the coverage from Noam and others have described.
I've found him to be a very honest reporter over many years, so I note that. But overall, in terms of the dynamic, I know you support this. What is it about the overall dynamic that makes you a supporter of these changes?
Yeah, so one of the most important things that this bill does is it takes the people who are on the Medicaid expansion under the Affordable Care Act and offers them heavily subsidized private coverage, very similar to that on the Affordable Care Act's insurance exchanges. But instead of having to disenroll from Medicaid and enroll in the exchanges and vice versa, if their incomes goes up and down and crosses the poverty line back and forth, they'll be on one insurance plan with one network of providers, with one physician. That will lead to much better care. And the medical literature is very strong on this, that private coverage does a lot to improve health outcomes in a way that Medicaid has not been shown to do. So the quality of coverage, the quality of access to care, because a lot more physicians accept private insurance that don't accept Medicaid, you're going to see better access to care from these individuals. And they're not going to lose coverage because they're all going to be eligible for very generous tax credits under this bill to buy health insurance.
The characterization we've seen, Obik Roy, is, okay, you're going to take money out of Medicaid over time, i.e. cut it, and we're going to see the poor and many of the elderly facing bigger bills under the new plan. Same time, we're going to see pretty substantial tax cuts for high-end Americans, rich Americans. Republicans have pushed quite explicitly for that. Is that fair?
So the Affordable Care Act cuts spending on Medicare, which is the health insurance program for the elderly, by $850 billion. Over the next 10 years, over the 10 years that we're talking about. And yet, you don't hear any Democrats talk about that or its effect on the elderly. Instead, we're talking about tax credits, which are, generally speaking, being used by a younger individual as somehow being catastrophic for the elderly. You never heard Democrats say that those $850 billion in cuts for Medicare were going to affect the elderly, which is quite strange and a total double standard. This bill, this Senate bill, is much better than the House bill. Tom, as you may know, I was quite a critic, a vociferous critic, of the House Republican health care bill because it didn't do enough to protect people who are in their 50s and 60s. This bill, the Senate bill, is much improved on that front. And I think we're seeing a lot of partisan rhetoric and prepackaged talking points rather than actual genuine analysis of what this bill does.
Wow. It's kind of pitiful when the conversation we're trying to have to understand something so fundamental, everybody just says everyone else is dishonest. We're just trying to strip away the varnish here and see exactly what's going on. Take your point, Obik Roy, but you can imagine for an ordinary citizen, you know, we have a reporter coming on say he's never seen such a dishonest debate. You're making a very similar charge. Please stand by there in Utah. Stuart Altman, you're here in the studio with me. Just stepping way back, 30,000 feet, what do you see in the changes that Mitch McConnell's plan puts on the table?
Well, before I get to that, I can't let that falsehood that Obik put forth about the $850 billion cut. That is pure nonsense. What happened
in Medicare?
On Medicare. What happened was the hospitals agreed to take lower payments from Medicare in return for the fact that they were going to get twice as much money from previously uninsured people. It was a deal cut with the hospitals. Mm-hmm. There was absolutely no cut in Medicare. Medicare beneficiaries saw the same level of care because the hospitals were willing to do that given the fact that they were going to get $2 for every loss. So that is nonsense.
Point taken. Step back. Look at these changes. What do you see their overall gist being?
All right. The second part is that $500 billion cut in taxes was used to underwrite Medicare. When the Affordable Care Act was passed, Medicare was scheduled to go broke, Part A, in 2017.
That's now.
This year. Mm-hmm. Because of the $500 billion increased money into the Medicare program, the Part A is now scheduled to go broke in 2028. If they take this tax increase off the table and take it away from Medicare, you're going to see the trust fund go, in terms of bankruptcy, back to maybe 2022, 23. So don't lose sight of the fact that this is much more. Norm Levy has it exactly right. This is not only for the poor. This will impact the whole healthcare system.
So, I mean, these are not small things. You're talking hundreds of billions of dollars here. And yet, I think it's hard for people to get all these pieces in mind and come to an overall conclusion about the direction American healthcare is going to take here. I mean, when you do that, Stuart, what do you see in the changes in toto proposed here in the Senate Republican healthcare plan? How does it shift? How does it change the profile of American healthcare?
Well, what it does is it fundamentally goes back to 1965 and says the Medicaid program that was passed then is no longer going to be the law of the land. I just want to give one set of numbers, which Norm talked about. In this state of Massachusetts, Medicaid per capita spending went up between 7 and 8%. If all of a sudden they only got 2%, which would be inflation, from the federal government, the state of Massachusetts would have to make it, but each year, about 5%.
And that's
that
just
is
one
not
state
a trivial
out of 50.
Amount of money.
Yeah. That's just one state out of 50.
And every state is facing the same. And those states that have been hit with the opioid plus the Sovaldi what happens in Medicaid, these are the sickest people. So they're the ones that are bearing the brunt of much higher increases in health care because of the new cancer drugs, the new types of care that's being provided to the disabled. So now what's going to happen is you're going to say to these states, the federal government's not going to back you anymore. We're just going to give you inflation.
Ovik Roy, are Republicans saying we can't afford this, so yeah, it's terrible, but we just got to cut it back? Or are you like Kellyanne Conway saying, no, there are no cuts here on Medicaid?
Well, first of all, I just want to say, Tom, that Stuart can say all he wants that there are no Medicare cuts in the Affordable Care Act. Your listeners don't have to take my word for it. They can look at the Congressional Budget Office score of the Affordable Care Act, which details the $850 billion in Medicare cuts over a decade very clearly. So this is not controversial in the fiscal community. And if people want to just deny that they exist, that's fine.
Yeah,
but again,
I
think it's important to have a factual conversation.
We got his description of the offset
sure.
there.
There's no offset. It's the net
offset.
Cut. The net cut is $850 billion.
Wow. So, what kind of public discourse? There's an offset. There's no offset.
I agree with you, Tom.
Does these conversations all the time, it just stinks when Americans just can't hear exactly what it really is. But okay, you guys disagree.
That's what I'm saying, Tom. You don't have to take my word for it. Your listeners can go to the Congressional Budget Office's website and look it up for themselves.
Medicaid, the spending is going to come down. Are you saying that's because it needs to, because we can't afford the kind of coverage that we've provided or put on the table since 1965, or that it's not actually going to be reduced coverage?
Great. So let's talk about the Medicaid piece. So we've talked about the Medicare piece. The Medicaid piece, we have to break it into two categories. So there's a reduction in Medicare spending that comes from the repeal of the Affordable Care Act's expansion of Medicaid. And that expansion, that represents about, depending on whose projections of future Medicaid spending you believe, that either represents 85 or 100% of the total reduction in Medicare cuts. If we go with the CBO's numbers, it's about 85%. If we go with the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, it's about 99%. So the vast majority of the so-called cuts to Medicaid, and they are cuts to Medicaid.
Yeah, so they're not so-called. They are cuts, just to be clear.
Wait a minute. Let me finish my point, Tom. So the repeal of the expansion of Medicaid is replaced by basically taking the same kind of tax credits that Obamacare uses to provide private coverage to people on the exchanges and make people eligible for that all the way down to zero income. So right now, the way Obamacare works is you're only eligible for exchange-based subsidies if your income is between 138 and 400% of the federal poverty level. In some states, it's 100 to 400% of the federal poverty level. Under the Republican plan, that drops down to 0% of the federal poverty level. So all the people who were eligible for the Medicaid expansion before will now be eligible for robust tax credits that are means tested so that they can afford coverage that's private and that, again, puts them in one system so you don't have to jump back and forth to different systems. So, yes, there are cuts to Medicaid, but you cannot talk about the cuts to Medicaid without also talking about the fact that there will be now this robust new system of tax credits to offer those individuals private coverage, just like that on the Obamacare exchange.
Stuart Altman, when we talk about Medicare, where the cuts of it describes come into play, you say, well, look at the offset. What about in Medicaid? If you want to talk about offsets in Medicare, do you have to do the same here, as Ovik says, with Medicaid?
This is just so much nonsense. Medicaid is a zero-based in terms of people having to pay, they get complete coverage, much broader than any private insurance, because these are the poorest people in our country. Once they go on private insurance through the exchanges,
using
they
tax get a, credits,
they get, a, they get a watered down set of benefits, much lower, by the way, than what's in the Affordable Care Act. And so there's some good news to that, but it's nowhere near dollar-for-dollar trade-off. Not only that, Obik talks about the fact that people prefer private insurance. Understand, in the exchanges today, because these insurance companies are faced with very limited amounts of money, they've created very limited networks. Actually, they're making coverage as tough as Medicaid coverage. So the idea that they're going to be substituting wonderful private insurance for terrible Medicaid insurance is just not true.
We've got callers for the two of you. New York, Dan's calling from West Seneca. Dan, you're on the air.
Guys, what I would like to know is why would you put a tax cut package for a very targeted percentage of the population in a health care bill whose ramifications on the elderly, the poor, and the very ill, the chronically ill, are devastating? And how come the federal government has never paid back any money that it extracted from the Social Security retirement fund? It was put into the general fund.
Dan, let us stick with health care for the moment and go to that. This has been widely characterized, Stuart, I'll come to you here, as saying big tax cuts for the affluent, the rich, and then the price paid by the elderly and poor. Is that fair? Ovik, I'll bring it to you, but Stuart first.
I think the caller is absolutely correct. Understand, this is not a health bill. This is a money bill. The combination of the tax reductions, but the big reductions in Medicaid spending, will allow the Republicans then to cut overall taxes. This is not a health bill. This idea that somehow this is going to improve health care quality is nonsense. What this is a pullback by the federal government in terms of paying for health care in America, and it will not only affect the poor, but will affect all of us.
All of us because of ripple-through effects to people who have coverage through their employer.
Absolutely. Norm had it exactly right. I've spent 55 years in this industry, and I'll put my reputation against anybody. Exactly what I said is going to happen, and what Norm said is going to happen.
That is?
That two things are going to happen. It's going to ripple through the whole system. It's going to have a negative impact on Medicare, and it's going to devastate parts of the Medicaid program, particularly in those states that have been more willing to provide decent coverage to their populations.
Ovik, tax cuts for the rich and poor and old, you know, take the hindmost?
Right, right. So in terms of the tax cuts, the reason the caller asked why are the tax cuts included in the bill? And the reason they're included in the bill is because they're the tax increases that were in the Affordable Care Act.
Right.
So the bill repeals the tax increases that were in the Affordable Care Act.
Yeah.
As to why the tax cuts are in the bill, that's the reason why they're in the bill. Obviously, you know, we'll all have different opinions about the virtue or value of tax cuts. I just make a couple of points. There are a number of tax increases in the Affordable Care Act that are passed down to consumers in the form of higher premiums. And so that's an important thing, to lower premiums for those individuals shopping for coverage on the exchange.
Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the Senate Republican health care bill, the GOP push to pass it, and the reality of what it would mean. You can join us this hour. Is this going to be our health care future? Who's got your back here on health care? Are you ready to ditch Obamacare and Trump care or McConnell care, whatever you want to call it, and go for single payer in the midst of all this debate? Ovik Roy is with us from the Foundation for Research on Equal Opportunity Conservative Think Tank, opinion editor at Forbes magazine. Stuart Altman is with us. He worked on the Affordable Care Act, advised President Obama on that, professor of national health policy at Brandeis University. Rebecca Given joins us in a moment to look at single payer. Some Americans may be saying it's time for that. Republicans having some trouble pulling their ranks together. This was Senator Dean Heller of Nevada saying the Medicaid cuts are just too much for him. Opposed.
It doesn't protect Nevadans on Medicaid and the most vulnerable Nevadans. The elderly, Nevadans struggling with mental health issues, substance abuse, and people with disabilities. On Medicaid expansion, probably half. Half of the dollars that were spent on that was on mental health and opioid abuse. Governor touched on that, and the fact that we think we can pull the rug out from under that expansion and those dollars for that insurance is a big concern of mine.
Republican U.S. Senator from Nevada in a very tough spot there in a situation where Mitch McConnell needs every vote he can get his hands on. Ron Johnson, Republican of Wisconsin, saying, why so fast? We can't get this done this week. Here he was yesterday on NBC's Meet the Press.
We don't have enough information. I don't have the feedback from constituencies who will not have had enough time to review the Senate bill. We should not be voting on this next week.
Too fast, says Republican U.S. Senator Ron Johnson of Wisconsin. Now, word out right now that today, Republicans, Reuters is reporting, will issue a revised version of the health care bill trying to address some of the concerns raised by their own members as Mitch McConnell pushes for this fast-track passage. We've got a lot of callers for you, Ovik Roy and Stuart Altman. Lizzie in Austin, Texas. Lizzie, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just wanted to comment that I'm not sure who your commentator is. It's in Salt Lake City. But the way that he's characterizing what is potentially going to happen, it feels like completely untrue. I'm actually living the situation that he's describing.
How? What?
I have three children, one of whom is receives Medicaid services, and the rest of us are all on private insurance through the Affordable Care Act. And he's trying to characterize that if we all go to private insurance, that's just going to be so much better. And I can tell you, Medicaid is an amazing system. And basically, the services that we've gotten for my child, the quality, the access, the comprehensive, the extensiveness, I mean, hugely outweighs what we get on.
Lizzie, why is one of your three children on Medicaid? Why, if I may ask?
Well, we waited on one of the Medicaid waiver lists for 13 years for her to get services. We signed her up when she was born. Like many, many Americans, we wait and wait and wait for services for her. So we paid out of pocket for her because she was not eligible for insurance for the majority of her life.
Did she have some special health challenge of some kind, Lizzie?
Yes, she has a genetic anomaly that came along with quite a few health challenges. So when she was 13, she finally came up on the list. We got Medicaid services for her, and it was like winning the lottery.
Stand by, Lizzie. Ovik Roy, can you assuage Lizzie's concerns that under this Republican plan, she'd be in trouble with her third child?
Yeah, first of all, I'm glad that the callers had a great experience for her child in the Medicaid program, and we have to make sure that everybody who's on government subsidized health insurance has that kind of experience. I'm glad that, I live in Texas as well. I live in Austin. Texas is a great example of a state that is going to do a lot better under this law than people are doing today, because Texas is a state that didn't expand Medicaid because of a lot of the concerns that we've talked about, and many that we haven't talked about. Now, under this bill, if this bill passes, there's going to be a much larger group of people in Texas with health insurance. All the people who would have been eligible for the Medicaid expansion but haven't gotten it because they haven't expanded Medicaid in Texas are now going to be eligible for these tax credits. The same thing is going to be true in Florida and all the other states that didn't expand Medicaid. So there are going to be more people with health insurance as a result of this bill in 5 years than are today.
I mean, maybe Lizzie wishes that Texas would have accepted the Medicaid expansion. But Lizzie, what about that? Do you feel better about what you're looking at?
No, I don't, because what he's saying is that then we'll be eligible to get tax credits to get private insurance. And I'm telling you, what's happened to us is that with the private insurance, we get less coverage. Every year there's less. They make The deductibles go higher. We have access to fewer places. There's more fly-by-night companies that kind of disappear, and then you lost your coverage, and you have to scramble to find something else. It's a piecemeal, and you end up not going to get any care. You end up not because you can't. Your deductible is so high for what you can afford, and the tax credits do not. It's just not comprehensive enough, and so. I mean, I just don't think that if it's going towards a for-profit system, it is not going to cover people like my child, ourselves, and really for us, the only answer is to move towards single-payer and complete Medicaid and Medicare for everyone.
Lizzie, let me hold that thought. There's frontline view of what's going on here, and I appreciate your call from Austin, Texas. Let me get one right here from Boston. Dave, you're on the air. Thank you for calling. What's your concern?
Oh, hi, Tom.
Hi.
So I just want to take 1 second to embarrass you for a minute.
Okay.
You are a consummate professional and have the widest breadth of knowledge of anyone.
Okay. What about healthcare,
right,
Dave?
All right.
Thank you.
Moving on. So my question is, in the 7 years I've been hearing that Obamacare is imploding, I've never really heard an explanation of what that means. And does this new bill address that issue? So if one of your panels could...
Sure. Stuart Altman worked on it. Is it imploding now? I mean, we hear about people, insurance companies pulling out of different markets, about some states where the premiums have really gone up. Does this fix it or kill it or what?
All right, let's put this in some context. There were problems. This is a comprehensive plan that worked 90% of the time.
You're talking the Affordable Care Act.
The Affordable Care Act. There were problems in it that need to be fixed. I don't argue against that. But it's like someone who gets a brand new car and after a week finds that the tire is leaking and therefore says, I'm going to sell the car. You fix the tire. The problem has been, as pointed out, that there are segments of our society that are being asked to pay a lot more. And that there are states, particularly those states that didn't expand Medicaid. Now, somehow,
like Texas, yeah.
We should feel good about them because they didn't do what they should have done. So it is true that these were problems that need to be fixed. The idea that the whole Affordable Care Act is in shambles is just not true. Now, there are issues that need to be fixed, and there are some provisions in the Senate bill that if they brought together the Democrats, they might agree to do them. But they're a small percentage compared to all the other stuff we've been talking about.
Let me get to Alice in Richmond, Maine. Alice, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Thanks. I'll bring the perspective of somebody who has to buy their own coverage.
Yeah.
I do not support repeal of the Affordable Care Act. I do not like the Affordable Care Act, and I find that there's a great deal of dishonesty on all sides. I'm not a fan of either major party. I absolutely think we need a single-payer system, and anybody who took a look at our system, it would never design this system. It's a disaster. But here's the reality under the Affordable Care Act. You know, one of the attacks on this Republican bill is that there's a premium differential 5-1 for older folks.
Yeah.
Under the Affordable Care Act, it's 3-1. If you are a 61-year-old widow in one of our rural counties in Maine, I call her Widow Annie, and she's a household of one, the subsidies are based on household size. It's 400% of federal poverty. This year, 400% of federal poverty for a household of one is $47,500 in gross income.
Okay.
That is several thousand dollars less than what the average public school teacher in Maine earns. This woman, Widow Annie, in Washington County, Maine, grossing $47,500, no subsidy, because she's 61 and because of geographic rating as well, her cheapest premium on the exchange this year under Obamacare is $967 a month per plan with a $6,000 deductible.
Wow.
And another couple thousand in out-of-pocket costs. My own premiums, I'm, 57. I went from $444 a month last year to $565 this year for a $5,500 bronze-level plan, and all the plans are going in for 20 to 30% rate increases. And I have 8 more years before I hit the Medicare life raft. So it's a disaster to be uninsured, and even insured under these high-deductible plans, it's a recipe for medical bankruptcy. Hospitals do not have to provide all the free care you need. If you have cancer and you're uninsured, you're not getting chemotherapy. They only have to screen and stabilize. So anyway, we need a single-payer health plan, and we need honesty on this topic.
Alice, we've got it, and my goodness, are you informed? I mean, Americans looking at this, Ovik and Stewart, and I think a lot of them at this point, just shaking their heads and saying, what the heck kind of system have we designed here, sort of top to bottom? Rebecca Gibbon joins us right now. She's a professor at Rutgers University School of Management, Labor Relations, expert in healthcare, a supporter of single payer. And we've got some callers saying, and, you know, a pox on all of this. Rebecca Gibbon, thank you very much for being with us today. As you look at what we've experienced with American healthcare before the Affordable Care Act, and then the last years with the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, now what Republicans are proposing with their the Senate bill, the House bill, and more, do you see, can this work, or are you ready to pull the ripcord and dive for single payer?
I'm pretty much ready for a single payer. Thanks, Tom. Thanks for having me. I think there's two main cases for single payer. One is kind of a moral case, which is, you know, just as we believe that everybody should have access to K through 12 education, we might believe, I believe everyone should have access to health care, and that should not depend on ability to pay or who you or your household members happen to work for.
So Rebecca, remind us what single payer is. I mean, most of the industrialized world has it. We don't. What is it? How does it generally work?
So single payer is healthcare where the payer is the government. It comes from some form of taxation. That might be payroll taxes, could be any kind of taxes. Single payer may or may not mean single provider. Single provider would be something like the British National Health Service. But
you wouldn't buy insurance. You'd just pay taxes and you'd have insurance. You'd have health coverage.
A lot of different systems, so you might have the option to select which insurance company you use to administer your health care, but essentially the payer is the government, and you wouldn't be using your private money or even necessarily your part of your paycheck to pay for health care. So it's a sort of perspective that health care is a human right and everyone should have access paid for by just like we pay for roads and fire departments from taxes, paying for health care from taxes.
Would that be more or less expensive than what Americans are dealing with now?
Yeah, that's what I was going to get to. So the other argument is really a practical one. So right now, when you add up tax subsidies, you add up public employees, almost two-thirds our health care is paid for by the government in one form or another anyway. And right now, the U.S. spends about 17% of GDP on health care. It comes to about a bit over $9,000 per person per year. And that comes out to roughly half public spending, private spending. So about a little over 8% of public spending and 8% of private spending. Most countries with excellent health care are spending less than 8% of their public spending on health care. So we could cut out all the private spending, just spend that 8% that we're already spending to cover 60-some percent of people and cover 100% of people, get rid of some of the profit, some of the waste in having an extremely high administrative burden, and spend way less than we're spending now and cover everybody at higher quality with better outcomes.
Ovik Roy, can you see how a lot of Americans might look at this debate and all the charges of honest, dishonest, and all the rest? Look at the complexity of it. Look at all the layers of it and say, forget this. We want to do what everybody else in the industrialized world does. Let's have single payer.
Well, I do agree that single payer is more economically coherent than the system we have today. I will gently correct you, Tom. It's not that every industrialized country in the world has single payer. There are a lot of different models out there. The industrialized world has universal coverage for the vast majority of these countries, but that's different from single payer. So, for example, a country like Switzerland doesn't have any government-run insurers. Netherlands is another example of a country that uses private insurers to deliver the benefit. However, everybody has health insurance because it's subsidized and regulated, et cetera. So there are different ways to achieve universal coverage. One of them is single payer. And again, I would say that single payer is more coherent than the system we have because you'd have one payer. That payer could dictate price and limit access to costly services, and that would be one way to bring costs down.
The GOP is pushing us the other way. I mean, the House bill, CBO says 23 million people fewer would have health coverage.
So the top of the point I was just about to make is there are other ways to achieve universal coverage. The health reform plan that we publish at my think tank, the Foundation for Research on Equal Opportunity, would cover more people than the Affordable Care Act, according to our models and projections.
But it's not what's on the table. It's not
based on a more consumer-oriented system that's not that different from the one that the Senate bill describes. So again, the thing that the Senate bill does that's so much better than the House bill, and it's really important for your listeners to understand, is that the tax credits are means tested. So the House bill, Paul Ryan bill, everyone got the same level of assistance, whether they were poor or wealthy. Under the Senate bill, the assistance is very heavily directed towards low-income individuals. So that's a very important component if you want to have a more market-oriented system that works for the lower-income population.
Stuart Altman, what about it? Rebecca Gibbons says, okay, forget it. Guys have had your day, and it is not working. Let's get out of it.
First, I couldn't be more sympathetic to the people that are pushing for single-payer. What they're arguing is totally correct. We should make health care available to all. But I am opposed in this current environment to single payer. I think if I could tell you.
Yeah.
Well,
got 1 minute.
1 minute. Right now, private insurance pays 100% more than government for the same cellular services. If all of a sudden we went to single payer, you would pull more than $1 trillion out of the American healthcare system. The impact on our healthcare system would be devastating. The other thing I would say to single payer, do you want the people who are now running your government to be in charge of your health care? The idea that somehow you would have a beneficent government that really cared about you, watch out.
Well, we'd like to. Rebecca Gibbons, you're ready to do it. You're not afraid?
I'm not afraid. I do want to say that the kind of coverage Ovik is talking about is, I call it junk-surance. It's nominally insurance, but essential health benefits will be gone. Deductibles will be, as the reporter said earlier, $8,000-$9,000 a year. It's nominally insurance, but it covers very little, and it takes us back to the bad old days of medical bankruptcies.
Wow. Junk-surance. Heaven help us. We'll see where this all goes this week. We'll be all over it. Rebecca Gibbons at Rutgers University, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you so much.
Ovik Roy, with us today from Salt Lake City. Thanks for joining us, Ovik.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for the opportunity.
Stuart Altman with Brandeis University, thank you.
Always a pleasure.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.